4. An Alliance for Progress. Benny. Benny Widyono was born in 1936 in Magalang, Central Java, into a family of Chinese descent. Immigrants from China, particularly the South, started moving to the islands of Southeast Asia centuries earlier. They often fled starvation or bandits, looking for work or at least refuge in a land where it was always warm and it seemed you could always just pick coconuts from the trees when you were hungry. Some Chinese came to Southeast Asia as early as the 11th century, and immigration continued until much more recently. Across the region, some ethnic Chinese ended up as workers or shopkeepers or small business owners. Some became quite wealthy indeed, moving to the top of the emerging business class. Their position in modern Southeast Asian society has sometimes been compared, in the very broadest sense, to that of Jews in Europe. Since the ethnic Chinese were immigrants, and neither peasants nor royalty, without an official place in the old feudal system, they had to work a bit harder and were forced early into industries that would grow in exponential terms as capitalism developed later. They experienced periodic waves of racism, not only because it was perceived they had undue wealth that would push them into ethnic enclaves, inspiring even more suspicion. Benny's family members were not shopkeepers. They were rich. His father farmed tobacco, to this day one of the most important crops in Indonesia. During the Japanese occupation, he was jailed and tortured for sending contributions to Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist forces back in China, leaving him with a lifelong disability. But after the Dutch left, business began to boom for the family again, and they employed a lot of workers. Growing up, young Benny would watch the Javanese men hauling huge sacks, bigger than their own skinny bodies, back and forth from the fields all night long. They begged the boss for higher wages, but he had no incentive to offer a raise. He was the only employer in town, and there was no real way for them to work anywhere else. Benny had a warm, inviting face, and he was always eager to laugh at the ridiculousness of life, but these scenes stuck with him. He went off to study economics in Jakarta under some of the country's leading academics. He began to learn about exploitation and monopolies, accumulation and profit. Then, on a visit home from university over the holidays, Benny had an interaction with his father that would probably be familiar to anyone who has sent kids off to college or gone to college themselves. Benny turned his radical new ideas on his dad. He called him an exploiter. "He almost kicked me out of the house," Benny would remember later, before bursting into laughter. The whole idea behind the economics degree was that he would take over the family business, and there he was with his newfangled left-wing notions, saying he was too good for it. But eventually, he and his father got over this little fight, and another relative ended up taking over the family business, so no harm was done. Benny was raised Catholic, even though his father was Confucian. But Benny took his mother's faith and ended up in one of Jakarta's elite Catholic high schools. The students there were all wealthy and mostly anti-communist. Some were solidly conservative. But whatever their political stripes, almost all of them supported Sukarno and his opposition to international imperialism. At school in Jakarta, even the right-leaning students felt real sympathy for the great leader of the revolution and were intensely proud of their young democracy. But in 1959, as Benny was finishing his undergraduate studies, the nature of Indonesian democracy changed. It took a big step backward. A few months after the regional rebellions backed by the CIA were defeated, Sukarno declared that the country would be moving to a system he had been discussing for a few years called guided democracy. As he put it, the system was a national response to the weakness of liberal democracy. Liberalism and party democracy, he complained, were a Western import that pitted everyone against each other, forcing each person to fight for their own selfish interests. That was not the Indonesian way, he claimed. He wanted a decision-making process based on the traditional village assembly, in which everyone got together and chose a course of action after careful consideration. Every party would be represented in the cabinet, called a Gotong Royong cabinet, after the traditional village practice of doing collective work, and there would be a national council representing civil groups like workers, peasants, intellectuals, religious groups, and entrepreneurs. The idea was that minority considerations could never be excluded. However, when Sukarno declared the system would be put in place in July 1959, he was overstepping his constitutional powers. He cemented himself as the leader of the government and major parties, such as the Mazjumi, the Muslim party that received CIA funds in 1955, then supported the regional rebellions, and the Socialist Party were effectively excluded from the new system. Western-style elections would not occur again under President Sukarno. Some back in Washington used Indonesia's slide toward a kind of illiberal populism as retroactive justification for their opposition to Sukarno's government. But the move to guided democracy happened after the CIA bombed the country and discussed killing its leader. The Indonesian Communist Party, PKI, Washington's bête noire in Southeast Asia, was the political group that most wanted voting to continue. The PKI had no interest in ending elections in Indonesia for one simple reason. It was doing better and better in them. In Singapore, British intelligence concluded in 1958 that if votes were held, the Communist Party would have come in first. It was the military, the most anti-communist force in the country, now building an increasingly intimate partnership with Washington after Ambassador Jones's recommendations, that forced the cancellation of the vote that was planned for 1959. The regional conflicts had enormously increased the influence of the army in Indonesian society over the past 2 years. The armed forces were granted emergency powers to fight the rebels, and the prestige of the forces under General Nasution got a big boost after they effectively put down attacks on the central government. As guided democracy went into effect, the army became one of a few key actors in Indonesian society. The military was to the right of the president, the communists were on the left, and Sukarno provided a delicate balance by playing political forces against each other. Washington took Howard Jones's advice and moved closer to the Indonesian armed forces to construct an anti-communist front. In 1953 and 1954, there were about a dozen Indonesian officers training in the United States, and that number dropped to zero in 1958, the year Alan Pope bombed Ambon. In 1959, zero became 41, and by 1962, there were more than 1,000 Indonesians studying operations, intelligence, and logistics, mostly at the Fort Leavenworth Army Base. This new approach dovetailed with a growing consensus within the United States that the military should be given more power and influence in the Third World, even if it meant undermining democracy. In the 1950s, an academic field of study called modernization theory began to gain influence in Washington. In its basic approach, modernization theory replicated the Marxist formulation that societies progress through stages, but it did so in a way that was highly influenced by the anti-communist, liberal American milieu in which it emerged. The social scientists who pioneered the field put forward that traditional, primitive societies would advance through a specific set of stages, ideally arriving at a version of modern society that looked a whole lot like the United States. Technocratic and resolutely anti-populist, modernization theory was pro-democracy when possible, but its proponents increasingly came to the conclusion that it might be better to just have some determined elite, say, U.S.-friendly generals, provide the crucial force for the difficult jump to modernity. In 1959, the State Department completed a major study informed by this logic. The recent history of Latin America, the study claims, indicates that authoritarianism is required to lead backward societies through their socioeconomic revolutions. The trend towards military authoritarianism will accelerate as developmental problems become more acute. The National Security Council met to discuss the report with the president and to shower its conclusions with lavish praise. In Indonesia especially, they began to view the army as they viewed themselves, as a bulwark against communism and a modernizing political and economic force. At the same time, young Indonesians were brought to study in universities in the United States through various scholarship and funding programs. The idea, as with similar programs around the Third World, was to show the young intellectuals how things worked in the U.S., which would hopefully inspire them to take pro-American ideas back home. Since 1956, the Ford Foundation had been providing fellowships that brought young Indonesian economists to the U.S. In 1959, much to his surprise, Benny received a scholarship to study in the United States. This was a very welcome development, as he was unsure about his future at home and still in a bit of a fight with his family. But he wouldn't be going to California as he would have liked. He was awarded a scholarship to attend the University of Kansas in Lawrence. He had never set foot outside of Indonesia before. The United States was a bit weird, he wrote in endless letters to his high school sweetheart. For some reason, he had to do a physical education class as part of his economics master's degree. On the one hand, Americans ate huge amounts of meat, which he didn't mind. But these people in Kansas would drink big glasses of cow's milk with their food, which he never understood. His life was that of a typical poor grad student, living in dingy dorms and trying to have as much fun as possible in between class and endless research. He and the other Indonesian students craved Indonesian food, but there was nothing like that in Kansas. There was just one stupid Chinese restaurant in the American style in the little university town, he told his friends. But Lawrence was just 40 minutes from the Fort Leavenworth Army Base, where members of the Indonesian military were getting their training. And Washington was treating them very nicely. To Benny and his broke student friends, it seemed like the military men were being downright wined and dined by the U.S. government. They had cars, and they had cash, so they would drive to meet the students in the college town, pool Uncle Sam's money to buy the best ingredients, and cook up a little Indonesian feast in the dorms. They were mostly Army generals, some of whom had even fought to crush the regional rebellions the CIA had backed. The young academics and the Army guys didn't talk too much politics, but it became clear to the grad students that the idea was to groom them to be anti-Sukarno generals, in Benny's words. They were all well-trained and Americanized, and many of them became anti-communists there in Kansas. The students and military brass spent most of their time bonding over the food and their homesickness, and getting drunk and heading into town for some fun. The Indonesian boys loved getting together and heading to Kansas City, where they could hit up the strip clubs. Indonesia is not a prudish country, but this type of show was something you couldn't catch back home. Benny also witnessed another distinctly American spectacle, the U.S. political process unfolding, viewed from the heartland. Not long after he arrived, John F. Kennedy took on Richard Nixon in a presidential contest. Benny and his buddies could watch the famous debate that aired on television on September 26, 1960, in which JFK, confident and attractive, proved perfectly suited to the medium, while Nixon, stuffy and sweaty, came across very poorly. But it was also the faltering economy, anxiety about the Soviet Union, the influence that vice presidential candidate Lyndon B. Johnson had in the South, and the support of minority voters that helped to win it for JFK. Just barely. He only got around 110,000 more votes than Nixon out of 69 million votes cast. Patrice, Jack, Fidel, Nelson, Nasution, and Saddam. After the prudish Eisenhower, the United States elected a president who was a womanizer just like Sukarno. The two would meet soon and get along well, but Kennedy's election seemed to herald serious changes for U.S. foreign policy, especially toward the Third World. Sukarno, like many Indonesians, viewed young Jack as a rare American ally in the fight against colonialism because he had read JFK's denunciations of French colonial rule in Algeria. As a candidate, JFK had run on solidly anti-communist credentials, of course. It was the United States, but in his inauguration speech, he also made a pledge to the Third World. To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves for whatever period is required. Not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right, Kennedy said. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich. To our sister republics south of our border, we offer a special pledge to convert our good words into good deeds in a new alliance for progress. However, JFK wasn't going to build the United States government from scratch. He would be inheriting the state as it existed and the CIA operations already underway around the globe. On January 17, 1961, 3 days before he was sworn in, as he was still writing that lofty speech, the whole world got a stark reminder of that when Patrice Lumumba, the young, energetic, and popular leader of the Congo, was executed. Lumumba had become prime minister in the wake of a decolonization process that was even more chaotic than Indonesia's had been a decade earlier. The end of Belgian control left the few independence leaders in the Congo scrambling to set up a government. Lumumba was dynamic and renowned for the fast-paced speeches that rolled over the radio waves across the territory. When the nation won independence, he was compared to the Sputnik satellite, and regular people looked forward to nothing less than a cosmic turnabout. The debonair Lumumba was more of a classical liberal than a leftist. Often wearing a bow tie, he was an Evolwe, a member of the class of Congolese who dressed to the nines, suiting up in European attire. He was an economic nationalist, not a committed internationalist revolutionary. Khrushchev observed that Mr. Lumumba is as much a communist as I am a Catholic. But just months after his election, the young, inexperienced politician made a serious mistake, at least given the rules of the global Cold War. As Belgian forces and mining interests backed a white-supported secession movement in the Katanga province, Lumumba turned to the United Nations for help. The UN offered nothing more than a strongly worded resolution, but Lumumba was desperate and thought he deserved troops. So on July 14, 1960, he sent a cable to Moscow asking for further assistance. It was immediately leaked to the CIA. As David Van Rybroek notes in his astounding history of the Congo, it would be hard to overstate the importance of this move. At a single swoop, this telegram opened up a new front in the Cold War, Africa. Did Lumumba and his team realize the impact the telegram would have? Probably not. Inexperienced as they were simply trying to obtain foreign assistance in solving a conflict concerning national decolonization. That wasn't Lumumba's only mistake, however. He made another big one in Washington, at least according to legend within the agency. After a frenzied set of meetings in Washington, he made a personal request. Like Sukarno 4 years earlier, he wanted to have an exchange with a sex worker, the story goes. This inspired revulsion, adding to the distaste U.S. officials already felt for him. In the middle of the 20th century, black men in the U.S. were brutally tortured and murdered for alleged sexual transgressions involving white women, including for simply whistling. Washington didn't like the way Lumumba talked politics either. Undersecretary of State C. Douglas Dillon said, "He was gripped by this fervor that I can only describe as messianic." New CIA Deputy Director for Plans Richard M. Bissell called him a mad dog. On July 21st, Alan Dulles said it was safe to assume he had been bought by the communists. On August 25th, the White House gave the order, and the CIA drew up plans to have him killed. Bissell asked Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, the CIA's in-house scientist, the same man who had overseen MKUltra, the program that kidnapped poor black men in the United States and dosed them with LSD to see if the agency could control their minds, to prepare a poison. The CIA made plans to inject it into Lumumba's food or toothpaste. That operation fizzled, so the agency ran an operation to lure Lumumba out of United Nations protection, where he could be killed by local rivals. Although ultimately without direct agency participation, this is what happened. Lumumba lost UN recognition on November 22nd, and 5 days later fled house arrest in Leopoldville. Troops loyal to Joseph Mobutu, the CIA-backed Army Chief of Staff and former friend of Lumumba, caught up with Lumumba, kidnapping him and delivering him to the Belgian-backed rebels in Katanga. Working with four Belgians, Katangan rebel forces stuffed Lumumba into the back of a car, then unloaded him near a shallow well. They shot him 3 times and shoved him into the hole. Lumumba's death made waves all around the world. People marched in the streets in Oslo, Tel Aviv, Vienna, and New Delhi. Belgian embassies were attacked in Cairo, Warsaw, and Belgrade. Moscow named a university after him. Mobutu took over the second largest country in sub-Saharan Africa, staged public executions of his rivals, built a dictatorship, and became one of Washington's closest Cold War allies in Africa. But for Kennedy, it was tiny little Cuba, just 90 miles from Florida, that occupied his attention for the first months of his presidency. When Fidel Castro's guerrilla forces overthrew the Batista dictatorship in January 1959, his movement was neither openly communist nor aligned with the Soviet Union. Indeed, he was accompanied by Che Guevara, the committed Marxist who had come to the conclusion, while watching the Guatemalan coup in 1954, that the United States could not be trusted. Capitalist imperialism, Che believed, would wage war on any democratic socialist project, and therefore armed struggle and a tightly controlled state were the only options open to Third World revolutionaries. But at the very beginning, Castro hoped for decent relations with Uncle Sam, and some in Washington even welcomed his victory. This fell apart quickly. Washington responded to Castro's agrarian reforms and nationalizations by imposing severe trade restrictions, which led Cuba to turn to the Soviet Union for badly needed fuel imports. During JFK's campaign, he attacked Eisenhower for being weak on Cuba. The Bay of Pigs invasion, whose planning began before Kennedy took office, was a fiasco for the United States and for JFK for two reasons. The first reason was bureaucratic breakdown. The CIA failed to communicate the true chances of success to the president and failed to come to a clear agreement as to the support its Cuban mercenaries would need after they landed on Cuba's shores and attempted to incite an anti-Castro uprising. The preparations alone created all kinds of problems even before the invasion began. The CIA considered calling off the operation, but warned the president that the mercenaries they were training in Guatemala would speak out publicly against Kennedy if they were demobilized. And in Guatemala, the presence of the Cubans led to a military revolt against the U.S.-backed dictatorship, setting off a brutal war that had been slowly preparing to explode since the coup in 1954. The second reason was that the United States thought Cubans would genuinely rise up to support an anti-communist revolt. In April 1961, 3 months after JFK took office, the opposite happened, and the Soldiers of Fortune were immediately arrested. Che Guevara might not have known how to build a socialist country quickly, famously struggling as finance minister, but he certainly wasn't naive enough to leave the country vulnerable to the same kind of Yankee scheme he had witnessed firsthand in Guatemala. It seems very possible the U.S. officials could have toppled Castro, as they toppled so many other governments in the region over the years, if they had applied more pressure or developed another strategy entirely. But the Bay of Pigs failure was so spectacular and so obvious that their hands were tied. The United States had shot its shot and couldn't try anything so public again. For days after the invasion, Kennedy's anguish and dejection were evident to everyone around him. Undersecretary of State Chester Bowles said that Kennedy was clearly quite shattered. Kennedy himself related that it was the worst experience of his life. He said he felt personally guilty for those who had died in the invasion, and it was a national humiliation. After the Bay of Pigs, two things changed for the JFK presidency, which had started with such idealism. From then on, he would have to deal with the CIA Wisner had created and with the problems it had bequeathed to him, and he would now govern while being accused of being soft on communism himself. Even Khrushchev ridiculed Kennedy for the failure in Cuba. "Although Castro was not a communist, you are well on the way to making him a good one," the Soviet leader told JFK. Privately, Khrushchev told communist allies he feared Kennedy was no match for the huge military-industrial complex in the U.S. and worried the young president couldn't keep the dark forces of his country at bay. It was just 4 days after the Bay of Pigs invasion, as JFK was still piecing his presidency together, that President Sukarno came to visit. For the Indonesian president, the parallels between the Bay of Pigs and what Indonesia had gone through in 1958 were obvious, but being the polite Javanese man that he was, he did not bring it up. The White House, in turn, took the advice from Jones's embassy to shower Sukarno with pomp and circumstance, while the Secret Service catered to Sukarno's insatiable demand for call girls. Sukarno could not get JFK to budge on West New Guinea, but reportedly was impressed with the man himself. Kennedy reportedly called Sukarno an inscrutable Asian. Just after his meeting with Sukarno, the young president sent a letter to Jones in Jakarta laying out clearly that he was in charge of the U.S. presence in Indonesia, including all other United States agencies. It was clearly part of an attempt to wrest control over foreign relations away from the CIA after the Bay of Pigs failure. Elsewhere in Southeast Asia, the agency's actions had been felt viscerally. Secret American plotting was exposed in Cambodia, badly undermining U.S. credibility in the region. For years, Narodom Sihanouk had railed against Eisenhower's anti-communism, believing the Americans were trying to get rid of him for maintaining a neutral stance. His claims were dismissed as far-fetched or absurd at the time, but he was right. In 1959, a CIA agent was instructed to liaise with Sihanouk's interior minister to organize a coup, which never succeeded. The South Vietnamese government of Ngo Dinh Diem also tried and failed to organize a coup in Cambodia with U.S. approval. After that failed, Sihanouk received a gift box. Maybe it was an attempt to patch things up. Instead, it exploded when his staff opened it, killing two men. The parcel bomb, the third attempt to destroy Sihanouk, was traced to a U.S. base in Saigon, but may have been sent without U.S. knowledge. However, and this crucial dynamic repeats itself throughout the Cold War, the incident would not have happened if the South Vietnamese thought Washington would disapprove. Broad U.S. plotting often led to events the Americans did not specifically predict. Either way, Sihanouk's relationship with the U.S. was damaged beyond repair. Kennedy's White House, and especially his brother Bobby, became obsessed with destroying Castro and put the CIA to the task. Robert McNamara, who served as Secretary of Defense from 1961 to 1968, later called the Kennedys' approach to Cuba hysterical. At a party, Desmond Fitzgerald, who had helped to create the Vampire Terror campaign in the Philippines, told a friend about his new job on the Cuba task force. "All I know is I have to hate Castro." The CIA had already sanctioned outlandish attempts on Castro's life. Under Eisenhower, they tried poisonous cigars and attempted to make his beard fall out. They apparently thought that Cubans would respect him less clean-shaven. The agency had contracted the mafia to murder Castro. Robert Mayhew, the former FBI agent who set up that meeting with the mob, was the same CIA freelancer who had arranged for the fake Sukarno sex tape. After the Bay of Pigs, the agency built upon this tradition. They created a scuba diving suit contaminated with spores, but couldn't get it to the Cuban leader. One plan revolved around an exploding seashell. The Miami CIA station became the largest in the world and offered cash bounties for dead communists. Edward Lansdale, the same man who had created vampire victims in the Philippines, discussed spraying civilian sugar workers in Cuba with biological warfare agents, as well as faking the second coming of Christ. Bobby Kennedy, whom Bowles considered aggressive, dogmatic, and vicious, was willing to employ even more drastic measures to shape Latin America as he thought fit. After the assassination of Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo, the Kennedy brothers debated the merits of sending in the Marines. Because this would not look good, Bobby suggested they simply blow up the U.S. consulate themselves. That could provide the rationale for the invasion. Kennedy did launch his Alliance for Progress economic cooperation program in Latin America, as well as the Peace Corps and the Agency for International Development. But his administration's active engagement to fight communism ended up being primarily with local militaries. His administration wholeheartedly embraced modernization theory and hired economist W.W. Rostow, author of the suitably titled The Stages of Economic Growth, a Non-Communist Manifesto, as one of JFK's advisors. Under Kennedy, the most important alliance for progress was made with armed forces around the world, and their task was to lead their countries closer to a U.S.-style economic system. Bobby played a special role in adopting the State Department's recommendation that Third World militaries should focus on counterinsurgency in addition to nation-building. That is, fighting wars against internal enemies and playing a broader political role in society at large. From the start, U.S. officials held up Indonesia as a crucial testing ground for this vision. The Kennedy administration provided increasing levels of assistance to the Indonesian military, which was meant to serve as a counterweight to support that Sukarno was now receiving from the Soviets. Despite the Kennedy brothers' obsession with Cuba, in 1961, the National Security Council listed Indonesia and West New Guinea among its most urgent planning priorities, because it was there that they believed Moscow and Washington were competing most directly for influence. Within a few years, Indochina would dominate international headlines, but until the middle of the 1960s, most officials considered Indonesia far more important than Vietnam or Laos. After returning to Indonesia from Washington, Sukarno did not let the issue of West New Guinea go. At the end of 1961, he gave a speech titled Triple Command of the People, or Tricora, demanding the dismantling of the Dutch puppet state and calling for the mobilization of the entire Indonesian people to regain the territory. General Nasution and other military leaders were wary of provoking war with the Dutch, but organized citizen militias and the navy clashed with Dutch ships. As Jones had been telling Washington, this was not about a piece of land for Sukarno. It was about completing his revolution and the legitimacy of his state, and Indonesians would go to war over this if they had to. Exasperated that his allies in Holland were proving so stubborn, and seeing this as a small price to pay to avoid losing Indonesia altogether to the Soviet orbit, Kennedy finally pushed the Dutch into a negotiation to hand over the territory. For Indonesia, at least, this was a shift from the days of Eisenhower and the Wisner method. Rather than attempting to destroy him, Kennedy gave Sukarno what he knew he needed. At the same time, the power and influence of the anti-communist Indonesian military, in constant coordination with U.S. officials with Washington, rose steadily in the background. Kennedy's positive engagement took the form of a civic action program, CAP, in Indonesia, which included the covert training of selected personnel and civilians, and a range of anti-communist activities whose nature, more than 50 years later, is still a classified secret. The CAP proved crucial in the creation of a Negara Dalam Negara, a state within a state, led by the generals. The process had begun when the military got emergency powers to fight the CIA in 1958. Now the military received equipment and training from the U.S. to engage in fishing, farming, and construction, which increased its economic interests and role around the country. In Africa, the U.S. took a different direction. With CIA assistance, white South African authorities arrested Nelson Mandela in 1962. U.S. officials also set the Middle East on a new path in 1963. Outside Indonesia, the largest communist party in the Bandung countries was the Iraqi Communist Party, ICP, which had grown in opposition to dictator Abd al-Karim Qasim. The ICP thought of making a bid for revolution, and the Soviets advised against it, but Washington backed a successful coup by the anti-communist Ba'ath Party, which immediately moved to crush the ICP. The CIA supplied lists of communists and alleged communists to the new regime, which slaughtered untold numbers of people. A Ba'ath Party member named Saddam Hussein, only 25 years old, reportedly took part in this U.S.-backed anti-communist extermination program. Some communists were shot in their homes, while others were taken to prison. Those who survived jail said Hussein had a reputation for being the worst of the torturers. They prayed to be taken in for interrogation on his nights off. The new Ba'ath regime overturned the land reform that Qasim had passed. In Kansas, the Indonesian officers kept pouring into the country and pouring into Benny's dining room. Presumably, they were now studying counterinsurgency strategies in addition to soaking up U.S. anti-communist ideology more generally. But that's not what Benny remembers about those days. They all had one big last night before he went off to get a PhD, get married, and start a family. In between Missouri and Kansas, there's a street called State Line Road. Benny, his student friends, and the anti-communist generals in training walked across to Missouri for some cocktails. The army guys wanted to find a specific club they liked, one with full nudity. They all got drunk, and the soldiers got their way.